Welcome to LBB's Open House, our podcast on how to build brands better. I'm Suchita. On the Open House podcast, I have candid conversations with founders, CXOs, and investors behind India's most compelling enterprises. As the co-founder of LBB, I love deep diving into all things marketing and distribution across different industries and learning from my guests. Joining me as a co-host is my colleague Asha, and you'll hear from her as well. Today, I'm in conversation with Vivek Prabhakar. Before we get into this episode, just letting you all know that Open House is recorded as a live session. Make sure you check out LBB, our app and our web, and sign up for our live chats where you can ask my guests questions in real time. Back to my guests now. Vivek is the co-founder of Chumbak, one of India's leading lifestyle brands. What started out as a souvenirs company with kiosks around India is now a force to be reckoned with. They've got over 75 stores across the country and have products in over 100 categories. In this conversation, we dig into the impact of COVID on retail. Chumbak's made a couple of super interesting changes to adapt better to the current environment. And he talks about categories and channels he's excited to build out. COVID aside, we also talked about changes Chumbak's made to position itself as a brand than just a product and what's coming up for them, including an international launch, hopefully soon. Vivek's been a dear friend to me and I thoroughly enjoyed talking all things shop with him on this episode. Let's jump right into it. Today's conversation is going to be about all things retail. What I definitely want to do is start with the elephant in the room, which is coronavirus, which has, rocked the boat. I think every single entrepreneur who had lofty dreams and lofty plans, everyone's kind of had to put the brake on them thanks to COVID. So, Vivek, how is COVID treating you, man? And how is it treating the team at Chumbak?
I think COVID was something, we were honestly completely taken aback in terms of how large it grew. We were tracking COVID as early as, end of Jan, early Feb, because I think close to about almost 15% of our product, some of the product we do manufacture in China. And, some of the stuff that was scheduled to come in and stuff that we were in touch with our manufacturers all the time. And our stress was, product's not going to come in. And that's the biggest thing that we could think of. Who knew it would be like this pandemic and we'd be all, sitting and lighting diyas at home and banging plates. But all jokes aside, I think no one anticipated this kind of slowdown in business, right? So to give you a perspective, we've got about 75 stores currently, and out of which over the last 2-3 weeks, we've had about 11 of them open. And of 11 of them, which are all in High Street, of course, all the malls are not open right now. Of the 11 of them, we've had business anywhere between about 15 to about 30% of what it was, last year, same time kind of thing. So there's no business in that sense because it's extremely, people who are walking in are buying, but our walk-ins are hardly 10, 15% of what they were in that sense. So e-commerce, for example, which is about 25, 30% of our business, has now started picking up. But again, maybe about 50% of what it was. For the first couple of weeks, we were taking a couple of orders, but unable to ship. And, that was the kind of thing. So I think the changes what we've seen from COVID happening is, when your back is to the wall, you're trying to figure out and completely hustle and get your hands dirty and see what you can do. It sounds silly, but we've been looking at every rupee. Not in large numbers, but even like, hey, this is going to cost $1,000. Is it worth it or not? And that's the kind of detail that we're going into and trying to get, get into new categories. We figured out, we started masks immediately, which did really well. It sold out. We've been doing some mugs here and there, but all these are small short-term fixes, So for a medium long-term, we're all still trying to understand where the consumer is going to be heading. Is the consumer going to actually come back to stores and malls? Is they going to shift completely to online? Is the consumption pattern going to shift? Is their behavior going to shift? For example, we do in this time of the year, we do a bunch of our backpacks kind of go, really large because of back to school and back to college and stuff, zero. This time we also, our travel section goes up, zero. So I think we're trying to figure out what's important to the consumer and trying to predict that. While we're all reading through 20 million of these reports that have been done in India and by people sitting in wherever across the world, I think nobody knows with a fair chance of, like, you know, saying that, hey, this is what's going to happen. This is what we should bet on. We have no clue what consumer behavior will be. And we've been looking at it from week to week and making minor changes here and there. But this is going to take a while before, I think, honestly, any retailer or any consumer goods company is going to understand what's happening from a consumption perspective.
But you, I'm assuming there's some operating thesis that you may have, right? In terms of at least categories that you see consumers being bullish on over the next couple of months, if not the next year. And also, you know, given the point that you made about how most of your presence is offline and you've got this, you know, a network of 75 stores, how are you guys thinking of adapting to a COVID world where people will think 10 times unlock or no unlock in terms of, you know, where to go and what to do?
So I think, you know, from a perspective, there are two parts to it. One is this entire, if consumers are going to say, listen, this touch and feel part of it, I'm okay to forego for my own safety reasons and I don't mind shifting to an online thing. Our entire online business, I think we've been, it's been focused for us from day one when we started in 2010. We started, in fact, Jumbook.com and we were retailing in stores from the first month itself. I think what we've seen is from a categories perspective, we've seen home, which is almost 39-40% of our business is now about 51% of the business. People are buying a little bit more of home. What are they buying? They're buying decor stuff. They're buying soft furnishing. They're buying crockery, stuff like that, which is still, you know, stuff which is for their house kind of thing and not really the larger items. Like, nobody's buying furniture, obviously. But the interesting thing is, I mean, we saw an increase of it, but with holding on, touch wood, apparel has not sunk so badly as we thought it would. I thought apparel will fall a lot more. I think apparel is holding its own and, you know, that's the thing. But I don't think it's going to hold on for very long. Once people buy, as I keep calling them, people are buying Zoom clothes right now after they finish, you know, picking up one or two things. I think our focus is going to be on home as a category and that's what we're going to be, you know, strengthening. It's always been, I think, core to Chumbak. That's something that we're going to do. So that's what we're doing from a category perspective. From a channel perspective, of course, e-commerce is something that we've doubled down on and, you know, we're seeing greater kind of rewards in terms of working with other marketplaces like Amazon and Myntra and so on and so forth. While Jumbook.com is an extremely strong player in our own online little world, it's now has to, I think, also start working with the other marketplaces as well. So that's the change that we're seeing. And the final thing, of course, what we're doing is all our stores are omnichannel. So we're going to start, I mean, we're just switching on a switch where we're now going to start shipping even Amazon orders from stores. So I think we're looking at, you know, making sure that there's some throughput through stores and all of that, because I think retail will be for a while a little tough.
Got it. And are you guys looking at, you know, newer models around retail? So, for example, I was reading these articles about how stores like Target, etc. are doing pre-orders and curbside pickup, right? There's also live streaming, which we guys have chatted about, which is huge in China. And let's see how it sort of, you know, picks up in India. Yeah. Are you guys experimenting with things like those?
So I know for a fact that I think about close to about 15% of our business in the last 3 weeks has come from consumer calls, calling our consumers and saying, hey, listen, there's something new. I mean, and as archaic and mundane, zero technology as sending WhatsApp kind of pictures to consumers saying, this is new, would you like to pick up? Sure. And they come to the store, pick it up and go. Curbside stuff, they're still coming into the store. I don't think they're this thing. We've seen about a 15% increase in the per average value of an order. So consumers are coming in and buying more. But we are looking at different versions of these newer things that way. It's too early days because I think consumers are, unless it's for grocery and stuff like that, there's not much shopping going on. So we're looking at these. As I said, week one, it was 7-8%. And this week, it's 16% of business, which is just telecalling and saying, hey, ma'am, it's been a while. You've got X points in your system. Would you like to come and spend it at, you know, the store? We've got this stuff, which is new.
But good on you guys, man, for being multi-category, which I actually has fortunately worked pretty well for us as well, where, you know, stuck only in one category, then making business recovery is super tough, right?
Yeah.
Even we guys are seeing a lot of our beauty merchants suddenly go into sanitizers. Now, how do you convince a customer who came to you for, you know, face mist to suddenly buy, you know, a low price sanitizer from you? So hindsight's 2020, I mean, net-net, things seem to be, I mean, you're kind of in a place where you can, you know, pick and choose your battles.
So actually, Suchita, this is something that we wouldn't, I mean, it sounds silly enough, but this is something that we figured sometime in 2004, 2005. This is before we started our large format stores that we have today. We used to be available in kiosks. We had about 40 of those kiosks that we used to be available in all malls across the country, which we closed every single one of them, then started building the larger format stores. One of the problems that we faced, what we realized in 2004, is that almost about 40, 42% of our business at peak were coming from phone cases. And we were the first in the market to do, you know, phone cases, and Chumbuk phone cases were a huge thing. Huge plus for it because, you know, people were buying it, and but somewhere it was being people were associating Chumbuk with phone cases, and you know that was one. And the danger of being associated as a lifestyle player that we wanted to become those days also was that, listen, if the moment I'm compartmentalized as this phone case brand, people will never spend more than $700 with me or $500 with me or whatever those days prices. So the conscious decision that we took is, listen, phone cases have to be under 10%. And that's what we did at that time, saying that we slowly brought it down. We killed all phone cases except for iPhone, raised prices, brought in higher quality and stuff like that, such that, listen, while we're available in phone cases, we're going to do the best quality phone cases that are there and for iPhone consumers who actually will spend a little bit more on, you know, that. And we don't want to be playing in the 150 rupee kind of price point or 200 rupee price point in that sense. So as phone cases came down, something else started taking its place up. So I think even today, from a categories perspective, there's nothing that is more than 10-12% of the total business. And that's actually really helped us out in, you know,
hedging your bets.
Yeah, in that sense, yeah.
Are there any short-term or long-term changes that you wanted to make with Chumbuk, which got, you know, accelerated because of COVID? I mean, for us, it's actually just been 2 months of, you know, pressing the accelerator on stuff that we wanted to do, but, you know, have been hesitant. Is there a silver lining to the COVID cloud for you?
I think the silver lining is just honestly, you've got time to now, when we were opening a store a week, till February, we were opening a store a week somewhere in the country, and we were running like crazy getting those stores up. And when we stopped opening stores, I think March 1st week or something, when we opened our last store, the thing that we realized at that time was, while we've been doing this, we've kind of taken our eye off on some of the essentials that are there, which were, you know, looking at inventory, looking at a couple of processes that have been broken, looking at tech a little bit deeper. I think what's happened is that if I don't have the day-to-day stuff and the pressure to run, so as to speak, which all of us funded companies have, is that it gives you time to like put down what, like go back to the basics a little bit and fix those. So I think what we've honestly spent time on is like honestly the nitty-gritties of the business, and saying that the last time we sat at this, we were at about 15 stores. How has our business changed when we're 75 stores? How do we need to change the back end? How do we need to look at inventory again? How do we need to, are these categories actually worth our time or not? Are we missing out in A category, B category? How would we looking at marketing? How are we looking at brand? How are we looking at all of this? I think the team's been never been busier, honestly, but busy doing, I think, strategic but really important things that will, once we start opening up all our stores and stuff like that, I think it will really pay dividends at that time. So we've honestly not looked at, you know, future wise, but we're honestly trying to, I mean, in the real most simple way, clean up a little bit of the mess that is happens when you're running, you know. So I think that's really helped us.
You also got a new CEO.
Yeah.
That I feel like everyone on this call needs to hear that. No, I mean, being a CEO is like not a fun job, guys.
It's a pain in the ass.
Yes, managing it's not fun. So you've outsourced that problem to someone else.
Yeah.
Good call, man. Talk a little bit about this, because you know, for a lot of people, you end up holding your business so close to your heart, and I think you know, there is a difference in between a founder and a CEO, right? Could you talk a little bit about that and what made you want to hand over the reins?
Yeah, I think so. This is something that was in the works for about a year, actually. And Shubhra and I were sitting across and trying to figure out, listen, we've brought the business here. It's been 10, it's going to be 10 years in 2020. And 2020 is going to be a great year. So, I mean, yeah. So we actually looked at the fact that, listen, we brought this to an X amount of business. We're going to be having about 100 stores by the end of the year. What will it take us to go to, you know, 5X revenue? Or what will it take us to bring in, you know, a bunch of talent that will help us get, you know, one of the things that we've been wanting to do and we've put off for a long time. We used to do it a little bit in Japan and all of that was, but international. How do we grow the brand internationally? There have been like almost like 20, 25 requests every month coming in saying that we'd like to take the brand abroad. We've got this. But, and, you know, it's never been right enough because I've always wanted to open stores abroad. And this is, you know, one of the things that was irritating us. The other thing that we felt was, I think from day one, Shubhra and I have had very clear, you know, lines in the sand in terms of responsibilities. She's takes care of product and she takes care of design and inventory and, you know, all of that product management, all of that stuff is what's her baby. I've always loved brand. I've always loved, you know, everything related with online retail stores and stuff like that. So that's the stuff that we've always kind of divided. And we said, listen, what's happening is over a period of time, we seem to be spending about 30% of our time doing stuff we love and 70% of our time doing problem solving stuff. And, you know, trying to figure out and deal with this, deal with that, deal with this. I mean, it's endless. Is there an opportunity for us to look at getting someone who, I think the number one word that both of us, you know, looked at was trust. That's the key. It's not that, you know, you suddenly go across and find a CEO kind of thing. So the CEO who we finally spoke to, I mean, who we got in, is a gentleman called Vasant Nangia. So Vasant actually was my boss's boss in my first job way back in 98. And he was a CEO at Tanishq at that time. And so I've known him for 22 years, right? And he has been like an advisor and mentor to me even at Chumbak in the earlier days. He was on the board for about 3-4 years before he shifted to Hong Kong in the last 4 years. And has always been advising here and there kind of stuff even when he was not on the board in the last 5 years. So I think we approached, he would joke and say, you know, these are such silly problems, why aren't you solving them kind of thing? And we'd meet him in Hong Kong and he'd be like, you know, hire me. And I'm like, forget it, you're too expensive, no way in hell that, you know, this will work out kind of thing. I think last year in April when we met, I think it was after a couple of drinks, but this conversation came up again, you know, saying that you guys, you need to do a whole bunch of stuff to grow, really grow. Somewhere you're doing a cut, copy, paste of feed store and it's doing well. And, you know, you've cracked that formula. But what next? What's going to take you to that, you know, 5X, 10X kind of levels in that sense? So, and that's the time we started, you know, having this conversation. And one of the first key things was that you have to understand in anyone who that you bring in, you've got to understand that you're not letting your baby go. Chumbak is still me and I'm still Chumbak and Shubhra is still Chumbak and Chumbak is still Shubhra. But you're bringing in someone who has done all these things before and knows them at the back of the, I mean, at the last role, he was head of APAC of Fossil, right? And he's done this at 15 countries across the world with his contacts and opening up Rolodexes and saying that, hey, listen, I want to be Chumbak and this kind of thing. But two things that were critical to this decision that I took. One is I had to trust the person. I mean, and there's no, it's like 100% trust. Not in the sense that someone would fuck me over or something like that, but in the sense that I trust this person in terms of what they bring to the table, who they say they are, and what they say they will do in that sense. Second, wavelength. It has to be there. I mean, you're going to spend so much of time with these people. You've got to be on the same wavelength. You've got to understand, listen, they get brand. If they get brand, I'm available in that sense. And third, I think one of the most important things is that while I've never felt like, I mean, if you ask me even 5 years ago, would you like to have a CEO who would take all the, of course I would. It's not that I'm not being able to do what I want to do at Chumbak. So I think not having ego in these kind of thing really helps. You've got to separate like this ego thing of saying that, you know, it doesn't mean that I am bad at what I do. It just means that I'm using my own you know, whatever I am good at and doing it better. And I'm bringing in someone who knows more about me in A, B, C. And that's perfectly okay. At the end, if Chumbak is growing, fantastic. So I think when I went to the board, they actually welcomed it with open arms, because obviously because Vasant was part of the board for those four years. And they had a couple of conversations, and I think it worked out really well in that sense. Sucks that he had to join during COVID, but but I think it's worked out really well. And I think if you're ever thinking of something like this, trust and zero ego on your side. That's the only thing that I can, you know, tell you that worked for me. It's extremely rare these kind of things work, but if it does and you have someone like this, eyes closed. I mean, it's the best damn thing.
So just a related question there, right? I think a lot of people obviously start off as founders, right? And the intent of the founder is to make your in, you know, whether it's make your product or sell your product, it's in between the two, right? But this journey of, you know, transitioning from being a maker slash founder to an executive is a hard one. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, two things in your opinion? What does a CEO do, and what's also the use case of a CEO, right? So if there are folks on this call who have young companies, do you even need to pretend to be a CEO in those scenarios, right? So when does the idea of a CEO kick in? And what do they do? And also, what are the metrics that, you know, a founder, maker, CEO, whatever, should set for themselves internally when it comes to judging parameters of how successful or, you know, unsuccessful your business is?
I think, honestly, the first 3-4 years of your company, you're de facto CEO. You have no choice unless you're with like 6 founders and you flip the coin, or you're the senior most of them or something like that, that you become CEO, right? And there, it's just a title, honestly, because at the first 4-5 years of you're doing everything. You're putting a hand into this, you're putting a hand into that, and you've got like 10 people in your team, and you can't be like delegating stuff and not be involved in that sense. I think what the difference is that till you find your perfect product market fit, you're still a maker. You're 100% maker, and you're going on looking for that. What's the bang thing? I think Chumbak, while we've seen iterations of Chumbak and, like, you know, at least two or three iterations from the day we started as this collectibles and souvenirs kind of accessories kind of brand, all the way to the lifestyle brand that we are, and we want to become a more premium lifestyle brand going forward. I think where we are right now, I don't know if it's so much of maker work that I have as much as execution work that I have. I think the strategic part of it kind of slows down over a period of time. And actually getting things done and kind of stuff works. So I think as a founder, my role right now is to continue to keep that spark alive of maker in the company. Whereas Vasant's role is very clearly execution and saying, listen, this is what needs to be done. This is how we need to do it. And you guys just go and do it. Whereas I'm still thinking of what's going to be Chumbak a year from now. What's going to be Chumbak's product or channel or international? How's it going to look like? How's online going to look like a year from now? That's my role, because it's in my blood. I know how to do this. And Shubhra's continuing to look at product and saying that, okay, this is what product contribution is, and COVID has brought these changes, what's going to happen? But a CEO is just clear execution and saying that this is what needs to be done and getting that damn thing done. I think that's one of the things that, you know, we see a huge difference between a maker, founder versus a CEO and a professional CEO in that sense.
And you're totally right. Execution is the devil's in the details, right?
Yeah.
And companies, the devil really is your execution. You have to...
And, you know, sometimes most founders don't have that. Some founders are fantastic at ideation and creation and strategy and stuff like that. But when it comes to execution, it just doesn't work out. They don't know how to do it. So typically a great team is made up of a maker and an execution person. So I think Shubhra and I were both makers, but learned to do execution. It doesn't come naturally to both of us. While we do it, and we've done it for 10 years, and we've been successful in that sense, but I don't think I can be successful at in growing it to like 5x of that. It's not in me. And that was the reason why I jumped at like having an opportunity. If I had an opportunity to get a CEO, 100% I wanted.
No, congratulations on that, man. Because like you said, it's a tough role to find a great person for. And it's good that you found someone from, you know, within your team, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
Your journey. I want to segue into, you know, the math behind a lifestyle brand, right? Because you spoke about how your intent of getting a CEO in is to 5x, right? How do you make this a 1,000 crore brand? Could you help all of us understand what are the makings of a lifestyle brand? What are the, you know, you guys have also diversified your channels to a fairly large extent from when you started to where you are now. Can we dive into that? Margins, numbers?
Margin number and all, sure. But before that, I think one of the things that defines the way we Chumbak started off is that from day one, we've had these kind of line drawn, and again, I'm saying line drawn in the sand, but like this, that brand is your North Star. Do not do anything that will hurt your brand. A couple of things that, you know, we felt, I'll tell you, when we were in, you know, when we just done our first round of, our first round of funding was, I think, in 2004, around 4 years after we started. And almost in 2006, we had started opening these kiosks. And, you know, there were small 100 square feet, 150 square feet kiosks in malls across the country. And somehow, one of the things that we felt was, you know, two, three things. Chumbak came in, you know, at a point where consumers, I mean, people would buy into Chumbak saying that, you know, you'd have magnets, keychains, a little bit t-shirts, stationery, all of that stuff. But consumers would come in and say, here's $500. What's new at Chumbak? Not necessarily asking for a particular product. And what we'd realize is that, you know, you'd give them a product which was average priced at about $200-$250, and you'd give money back. Very clearly, we were leaving money on the table. Mm-hmm. And that's the time that we realized, listen, Chumbak, from a consumer perspective, from a brand perspective, have reached here, but we are like idiots servicing it here from product perspective. We needed to not bridge the gap, but go really high. And that's in 2000. I mean, it took us a couple of years, but I think 2014 is when we started reworking this entire thing and said that, listen, we're going to build large format stores. The decision to kill 42 kiosks, which contributed almost 85% of your business, was an overnight kind of call saying that these things are hurting your brand. You don't want to be known as a souvenir collectibles brand for the rest of your life fighting for 200 rupee product. If you're going to do that, you're going to go and open suddenly a 2,500 square foot store in Bangalore to test it out. You've got to go and put in furniture there and sell product at $35,000. You've got to start home as a category. You've got to evolve design. So we looked at design. We looked at the kind of channel that was there. And of course, uplifting the entire brand. It hurt us for a while. Almost a year, year and a half, we were flat in that sense, because we had closed down these malls, I mean, these kiosks. But that decision proved to be right, because brand held its own and we did not f*** up the brand. Saying that, listen, if Chumbak means this, let's just do this. Let's not get into, like, you know, trying to do 500 kiosks. It's never going to happen. You're going to be like a small thela kind of thing in this. It's great to start. It's great to kick off. It's great to give you a little bit of distribution and traction in the beginning, but it cannot be your entire story. And I think those are the things that actually earlier on we said, listen, we've got to, we started home as the first large category, then said fashion and then accessories. And these are the, like, you know, the three legs of our chair, and I mean, our table in that sense, that complete this entire conversation about lifestyle brands. The last one, which we started working on, but I mean, Corona's delayed it, was beauty. With the entire, you know, color cosmetics and stuff like that. That's another category that we believe that will be a large part of the business. So yeah, I think from that perspective, typically margins, as you said, margins need to be close to a 60 to 70% minimum for you to make any money in terms of, you know, the kind of pricing that you do, the kind of stores that you have, and the cost of retail that, there is. And over a period of time, as I said, bringing in categories and not letting one large category define you. Today, Chumbak is known for many things, and people come in to buy Chumbak, not, you know, a particular product. People, stats show that people who buy only one particular product is about 15% of our universe. We've had close to almost a little over a million consumers shop with us. We've got about that much of data with us, but we've seen only about 15% of them buy one category and stay within that category. 85% of them will try something else, will try a little bit of apparel. Then, hey, this, you know, cushion cover looks right. Oh, this crockery looks really nice. And this bag looks really nice, or this watch looks really nice, and then move around in that kind of thing.
So related question that is a little counterintuitive to the original advice given around brands, right? Which is do one thing and do it very well, right? What are the inflection points that you think, you know, founders / CEOs or whoever else need to look for in their businesses, which propel you to want to say, you know what, I need to have a larger like SKU product category mix in order for me to actually become a lifestyle brand?
I think when I explained that example, entire example of phone cases, right? We were damn thrilled at one point of time that phone cases was something that are, you know, crazy. We were making crazy amounts of money on it. We were making them in-house. So margins were fantastic, almost 75% kind of margins we were making. Then one thing happened. Our phone started being counterfeited. And at one point of time, our estimate, and sold like in front of a metro station, Palika Bazaar, here, there, everywhere. We estimated at one point of time for every one phone case that we sold, there were 500 fake phone cases out there from Chumbak. With Chumbak branding, it was a Chumbak phone case. People came in asking for Chumbak phone cases at those kind of places. One we realized is the kind of, you know, product categories that one might have cannot restrict you to one particular kind of the thing. We made that mistake once where we saw, you know, a 41-42% of your business coming in from a single place to, you know, the dependency on that was very high. Secondly, in a lifestyle brand, I'm not an apparel brand. I'm not a home brand. I'm not an accessories brand. It gives me the flexibility to move from category to category to category. If apparel is slowing down like it is right now, amazing. I've got home and which is growing like that. I do not want to be, you know, it works for Chumbak. It may not work for other people, but it works for Chumbak, saying that I need to have that width of assortment to offer the consumer. I mean, I know it's counterintuitive and we kick ourselves trying to manage stock and inventory and all, but we're getting better and better at it. I mean, we're throwing a bunch of tech at it. So it is getting better and better. So yeah, we're learning.
And what's your big vision post-corona, right? So let's think of 2021, hopefully happier times. Hopefully people are out and spending again. Where do you see Chumba going? And, you know, I mean, you guys have also built so much traction around your brand. As someone on the outside, the question that, you know, one has is, how does this get bigger? What does bigger look like? So could you talk a little bit about that as well?
So one of the things that we were working on, I mean, I'm saying, like, as I said, I think product, from a product perspective, I think we're done growing for the next 2-3 years. I'm not going to add 20 more categories and, you know, make it suddenly big. Beauty was one thing that we were working on. We will launch that sometime during this year. And, you know, that's going to be big enough for us. But I think our main area of growth, or where we see ourselves, what was supposed to happen this year, just moved a year, is, I think, our international growth. So I think we're starting off with the US, we're starting with Australia, we're starting off with Asia Pac, and opening Chumbak stores, standalone Chumbak stores in these areas as well. So we're now, in fact, earlier we were looking at 5-6 countries, now we look at 2 countries and do it a little bit more slower, and saying that, try to understand what kind of successes that we have there. We're working with partners, trying to understand, listen, if in Australia we're opening, where are the places that we're opening? And this is what, as I said, our new CEO is doing. Our new CEO, it's a matter of phone call saying that I need you to open a Chumbak store for me. Okay. So, and it's stuff like that. While we were trying to figure out, we had visited Hong Kong. I mean, we've been in Hong Kong, we've been in Dubai, in Tokyo, trying to understand and work with partners and stuff like that. But we see that doors are opening much faster. Conversations are happening much faster. And we'll probably do about 10-15 stores next year internationally for sure. We were supposed to do about 4 this year. I think about 10-15 is what we'll do next year for sure.
That's amazing. And who are you thinking of? Indian customer in these countries?
No. Okay. No. So I think what we've done is we've got, at any given point of time, about 2,500 SKUs live with us. What we've done, as I said, what have we used our downtime, corona time for, was this, right? So we've pared that down to about 750-800 kind of products, and taking out references of your, there's no souvenirs. For example, we're not going with apparel. We're going with accessories, we're going with watches, we're going with bags, we're going with home. But taking out this entire India stuff that, you know, is there in the smaller priced products, and not going with that. Plus, we're doing another 250 products with a little bit more international kind of design sensibility, in that sense, which we started designing in the last couple of months. And we're going with that. The target consumer is not Indian. The target consumer is a local then. Very clearly, you're a brand. You're not an Indian brand catering to Indian consumers. You happen to be a brand based out of India. That's all. That's the only India part about you.
But again, I mean, you know, especially now with this sort of, and if I could just draw a corollary to another category, if you look at something like food and beverages, right? Actually, let's skip to beauty. Ayurveda and all natural, you know, remedy-based sort of, you know, beauty and skincare is taking over the world, right? Wouldn't this be a good time to play on your Indianness? Like, wouldn't this be a good time?
So you're not saying no to India. You're not saying that, listen, I'm not Indian and this thing, you know, it's in our name. We'll never die from Chumma plus Buck is kissing stones and Chumbuk and all. We'll never run away from that. We love the fact that we're Indian. We're proud to be that. But I'm saying the fact that I don't want to, I've seen, so we've spoken to a bunch of people who've done this earlier. Indian brands who try to go international and have hit a wall in terms of Indian consumers will not spend. They don't spend money on Indian brands over there because they come back here and buy it cheaper. So, you know, even apparel brands we've spoken to and they've had huge issues. But however, if I'm saying that I'm going to portray myself as this international collection kind of thing, but happen to be from India, if it's an Indian consumer who buys all this stuff, fantastic. I have no stress. I'm not going to say no to that. And of course, I can't take away the India outside. I mean, I can't take away India from Chumbuk. All our product does have a little bit of India in it. But I'm not going to shout it out, is all I'm saying.
Got it. And with your international, I'm so excited for you, but like, you know, with your international market expansion, is that coming from a place of, you know, the Indian customer who is actually accessible to a brand like Chumbuk is up to X? So now instead of trying to deepen your presence within India, it's, you know, what this customer is going to grow at X percent year on year. I don't want to push this too much. Let me try capturing a customer from somewhere else. So,
honestly, in our business plan at even 2 years from now, considering COVID hadn't opened, we stopped at 250 stores. We were supposed to be about 100 and something, 100 by the end of this year and about 150 by the end of 2020. I mean, financial year 2020-21. We were stopping. I don't think we need to do more than 200 plus stores. And online, which plays a huge role in this, a lot of stuff is then moving to online. Saying that, you know, we've seen brands with 200, 300, 400, 500 stores, then your per store productivity goes like really down. Then that doesn't make sense. I mean, I understand that you want to open the third store in a beast town, right? But what's the point? And you're saying, no, don't worry, the rent is only like 1 lakh. But sales being 4 lakhs or 5 lakhs doesn't help anybody. So in that sense, we're saying that, listen, stop at these 200 stores or whatever that number is. The next level of growth will come from international markets, where it's virgin territory for us, saying that, listen, this is what we've never done this before. And we'll test it out in a couple of markets. We'll do 5-10 stores, see if it works, fantastic. And we'll approach it the same way. We work with Amazon, we work with our own Chumbuk.com, and we open stores in that sense. If it works, fantastic, go all over. If it doesn't, tail under leg, come back, fix something that's happening. Because in India, honestly, we've understood our 1,000 square feet model perfectly. We know exactly how to do it, what to do it, when to do it, where to do it. We've got that. So in terms of actually management, time that's going into each particular store has been coming down. The teams just cracked it and they've done a fantastic job of opening these stores week after week.
Got it. I want to sort of, you know, switch gears into what Chumbuk does so well, right? Which is your brand. And you sort of, you know, mentioned that the sort of holy grail of having a brand is that a customer comes in wanting your brand, not really caring about what they're buying.
Yeah.
From, right?
Yeah.
So two quick questions there. First one, what are your favorite brands apart from like the Nike, Adidas, the more obvious bets? What are your favorite brands
that I look up to? Honestly, yeah. I mean, it's silly, but I've always looked up to Nike. I mean, you'd mention it, but I've always looked up to Nike. The random one, which is Apple, but I've always looked up to Apple. Of some of the other ones which I've really liked are Airbnb, obviously. I love what Airbnb does, even at a local level, that the stuff that they do is fantastic. I've loved Anthropology. There are many brands that I love. And I mean, these are the brands that I look up to and saying, like, listen, if these guys can do ABC, I'm sure we can learn a little bit from each brand. While they may in different categories and stuff like that, we can learn from each of these brands and, you know, the way they treat consumers, the customer delight stuff that they do, the way they do VM in stores, it's just phenomenal. And it's stuff to learn. So Yeah.
And second question, what do you think makes Jumbuck a great brand? And if you could talk a little bit about, you know, everything from your in-store experiences, some of which you've done with us, or you know, your VM, your photos. I was in fact commending you and your team on your Instagram is stunning, right? Which you've invested a fair bit in off late. So could you talk a little bit about how Jumbuck's built itself to become such a cult brand?
So I think two things, honestly, we've done hopefully right. One is, I think, consistency. We've always, as I said, brand does not stop for us. We've never done stuff that, you know, if it doesn't make sense to us and it's going to hurt the brand, but great sales do not do it. You know, each DNA of a company could either be a sales-driven company or a brand-driven company. And each is good and bad. A sales-driven company sometimes looks shitty from the outside but does fantastic revenue. A brand-driven company looks fantastic from the outside but might do shitty revenue in that sense. But I think we've kind of put brand first, saying that you can't recover from a screwed up failure on the brand side. The second thing, so consistency was up. The second thing is that I think something that we learned really early on is to do this in-house. The passion that which the team works with, we've got almost about 10 people in the marketing team, 9 of them women, one little 23-year-old boy, but who does copy and stuff like that. But they get the brand. They know the brand inside out. They know this stuff every day in and day out. They use the brand. They know it. I think even when we could afford just 2 people, it was always done in-house. We've never outsourced anything to an agency saying, shoot, to Hakaro, this social media agency, leke aao, none of that stuff. We've always felt that if you're going to build this company basis an amazing and become an amazing brand, you need to own this end-to-end. I mean, so if it means investing in a studio, if it means investing in a team for, I mean, we've had stylists, we've had photographers, we've had, you know, all these people in-house. So that's really helped. So consistency and getting this in-house is phenomenal, you know, mileage that we've seen. And the third and last is, don't talk product, do storytelling. I think that's the biggest learning that we've had, saying that create stories around products and people will continue to, people will come in and buy product. That's been our learning in that sense.
I'm making a note as you speak. I think on the last one, I'd actually literally written exactly this on LinkedIn recently, where it's so wild how people are obsessed with performance marketing, right? And again, don't get me wrong, I'm not against it. I think it works very well for low margin, high frequency products.
But there's a time and place for it, Suchit. You can't do performance marketing without having a story.
Absolutely.
You amplify the story with performance marketing, but you need to first spend on story. Honestly, I mean, earlier days also, then we used to do Jumbuck. I mean, my marketing team didn't have an ROI calculator. That's the only way you build brand. I mean, you say that, okay, these things will help in the longer run and you invest in it if you can. It's not that we were spending crores of money. We would have like we would spend like 50,000 rupees a month. We spend, go up to maybe 1 lakh rupees a month kind of thing, right? But that money that we did was purely brand related. And even today we have a separate kind of reason for performance marketing to exist in the company, which is for e-commerce to sell a particular product that person has seen. But it doesn't take away from the brand team's money to bring in the aura or the stuff around the brand and to build the brand as such. I'm not going to be performance marketing without this is zero.
Absolutely. Okay, so my job is done. I have made you talk nonstop for 50 minutes, and Aastha is like giving me the dead stare from Zoom. She just,
I really am not.
it's my turn. Questions. People have questions. I'm going to circle back all the way at the end for one final question with you, Vivek.
Sure.
I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, Aastha. Please take it away.
Okay, so one thing that started off right in the beginning, I think, is some people are really looking for advice. So Atisha, Geetika, Varun, Viraj, all of you have asked the same question in different ways, and I'm going to try and articulate that. Everybody wants to know, post-COVID, if they're running a small brand, should they go online and invest in their own website, talk directly to their consumers, should they get onto a marketplace? Or should they invest in stores? It's like a broad question, but that's what
it's
commonly.
With someone who has 75 stores, I'm going to say don't invest in stores, obviously. Not now. I mean, you need to get a great online presence first. and in online with limited money marketplaces. First, have a website that tells people the brand is built on your own website, where you talk story, where you give kahani, where you give gyan, where it's pictures, it's imagery, it's videos, it's the love that's there. But you will never get 1/1,000,000th of the kind of consumers that an Amazon, for example, gets. So build your brand on your own website, but sell on a marketplace for sure.
Got it. That was fantastic and short and sweet. Okay, Abhimanyu, your question's up next. When you have so many SKUs, right, how do you curb and manage your working capital?
So I think, honestly, we work with, there's a lot of science that goes behind this. I mean, so all our systems, we run on a very large ERP, which I would say we overinvested and did it really early, like about 6-7 years ago. But we're seeing the dividends of it every single day, right, of overinvesting in technology, where we see that at any given point of time, at real time, I know what the kind of product status is. So the way we roll out, for example, let's talk about a new product category. Suppose I'm doing phone cases as a new phone cases. Each design is graded by the design team on a A plus, an A, and a B design. So there are three types of design this thing. A plus is ordered, say, 5,000 pieces. A is ordered, say, 3,000, and a B, 2,000. The gut feeling in terms of what is there is based actually on previous sales data. For example, each product also has color attributes to it, what we'd select. So I know, for example, the color purple, if I put on a product, I will not sell a single damn piece of it in this country. For whatever reason, Chumba can't sell something with purple on it, right? So those kind of inputs are coming into the design team. And the designs are then graded not just by them, but by the system, saying that if this is the input that you've given me, I know that you'll be able to sell this, you'll be able to sell this in these many stores. Second is we understand that a lot of our stores, which are also graded into an A, B, C in terms of the size of the stores, are also pretty homogeneous. I mean, we're lucky for that. What sells in a Lucknow, sells in a Bangalore, which sells in a Bhubaneswar, sells in a Delhi and Bombay. Maximum, our top 10 might be about 80% of it is similar. So inventory planning is done honestly on a day-to-day kind of level, which we have a planning team that looks at both supply planning, which is inward product, how much to order, and demand planning, which is inward, and supply planning, which is to stores and to e-commerce. So what we do is that inventory is managed. What we look at, what is the kind of budget that we have for the year, and then work around those things. So there's a lot of science that goes into it. We're pretty good at it, but inventory is that magical beast that you'll never hit nirvana. You'll never be demand is equal to supply. You'll always be in cases, I have some stuff which is huge amount of stock and no demand, or I have huge amount of demand and no stock. Those cases, whatever we try, will still happen. The idea is to bring those cases down to like as many less number of cases per time.
Yeah, and a short related question to that, how much does this change after the China situation? Have you thought
it
about
doesn't.
Moving
so, in? I mean, China is hardly about 15% of our inwards anyway. So, I mean, it doesn't change that much in that sense. In fact, China is the only country in the world that's actually manufacturing right now. So, I mean, they're all like, hey, where are the orders? And we're saying, hey, listen, I don't have my store open. Come back in 2021 kind of thing.
Okay, last question before I hand it on to Sichita. Varun Jain had asked that about the bringing in a CEO and an advisor, right? What is the correct time to assemble a board like this? An advisory board of sorts, and how do you suggest a startup do this?
So advisory board is day one. I mean, you've got to have an informal advisory board day one, people you look up to, ex-bosses, people that you've known, like literally most of the time they are ex-bosses who you've got along with, but people you've known or other entrepreneurs who have had the time and energy to spend some time with you. Day one, you get the advisory board together and get people who know execution, but not necessarily your business. As one. And second part of it, get people who know strategy and, you know, are from your kind of sphere of working in terms of if you're in services or if you're in tech, if you're in health, if you're in consumers, get someone from there who's more strategic, but get someone else who's like a pure hardcore finance guy who's a fantastic execution person, or an ops guy who's a fantastic execution person. So we've always had a bunch of advisors, about two or three advisors who we've always gone back to and said, help.
Got it. Sorry, Sujata. I know I said this was the last one, but we do this every time. And somebody just pinged it, so I remembered. When you start something and when you feel like it's not going right, and we also always ask, you know, all the founders and sort of experts we speak to about failures.
Yeah.
Anything that you can actually leave, you know, advice for these people who are like starting out, dealing with failures, an example to that?
I think so. When you're starting out, I think Shubhra and I set out very clearly, very like we acted very like Chauda kind of thing. And we sold our house after drinking a cheap bottle of wine and said that, yeah, let's do this. People need chumbak in their lives and shit like that. But those kind of things happen pretty rarely where like we had the option to do that. But even then, I think one of the big things that we did was it's not about the money. If you're going to chase the money, then your focus is on getting money and not building the company. Like then you're trying to figure out there's nothing wrong in that, but more often than not, you fail because you're not spending time getting a product market fit. You're trying to figure out, hey, why am I not rich? Why don't I have a corner office? Why am I not like, why doesn't the CEO actually mean something in that sense? So we've always felt that don't chase the money will come. So failure, I think each time you start off something, set a deadline to this and say that, listen, I'm going to give it 6 months. If it doesn't happen, zero ego. I've learned shit loads, but zero ego, I close it down. It doesn't matter. So I think from a failure perspective, we've hired so many entrepreneurs who've, you know, started stuff and their ideas didn't work out, market fit wasn't right, or their time wasn't right. I mean, the kind of experience, honestly, that these people bring to us is phenomenal. I've learned so much from people who said that they are failed entrepreneurs. There's no such thing as a failed entrepreneur. They're just entrepreneurs who, it just didn't work out, it's fine. So I think just like set timelines and don't get so stressed about having ego. You can always go back to your jobs.
On that amazing note, I just want to say, you know, to everyone who's on this call, I honestly have had, you know, the most amazing conversations with Vivek. He's him and his home and his dog and his daughter and Shubhra are like my family in Bangalore. And I think what really stands out, you know, with Vivek and why I really, really wanted all of you guys to hear from him is two things, just persistence, right? I mean, you've been at it for what, 10 years? And I think that's one thing that people don't realize, that it takes a lot to build a brand. And even at the end of 10 years, you're always going back to the drawing board, right? So going back to the drawing board is not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's actually the...
Not at all.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because 10 years, man, that's wild. It's not... and especially with everything you've had to, you know, give up along the way.
The amount of challenges that you face as an entrepreneur... you can't be sitting still. I mean, you have to constantly learn. You've not just from an internal perspective, the kind of shit that one has to go through. You've got to deal with people. You've got to deal with their problems. You've got to deal with vendors. You've got to deal with customers. You've got to deal with stores, all of that stuff. But also with a lot of external stuff that's not in your control. Back in 2016-17, Suchita knows this. We had a huge issue with suddenly the government changed rules on single brand retail in terms of investments from other countries. For a year, we had no money. We stopped opening stores. I mean, it was honestly, this feels like that kind of time because again, we were all sitting in offices doing no work to do at stores or anything like that. But I feel those are the best times where we reinvented and some of the best ideas came with, you know, you're back to the wall and you have no option except to reinvent yourself time after time after time. And you know, it's an evolution. It's not like I'm pivoting each time, but it's an evolution. And every single brand on this planet has had an evolution, even from like what I mentioned, Apple, right? I mean, what were they doing and what they're doing now? I mean, it's a huge difference. They weren't then, they're a phone company now, which they weren't. They were an iPod company before this. And before that, they were a computer company. So I think the idea is that constantly reinvent yourself and, you know, zero ego and move on. I mean,
last question. So what are the books, the podcasts, the things that you've read, the people who you follow, you know, things that just inspire you and pick you up, man, and folks who all of us can learn from, right?
Honestly, I'm the wrong person to ask this because I think a lot of my reading happens on stuff that is non-work, non-Chumbak stuff, which I kind of stay out of. One of the things that I like to read stuff about business, and 95% of my reading is nonfiction. And I read the same stuff on technology, on startups and stuff. But I think somewhere along the line, what I've learned is that I've started to read about other businesses and other sectors more from not about, like, I'm not only reading about the consumer lifestyle business, but I'm reading about companies and how they've been built and how they've, you know, moved on in that sense. And what are the learnings that, for example, Airbnb had in its first 10 years or 5 years, or what were the things that maybe Flipkart had, and what are the mistakes they did? I think those are the kind of things that I'm slowly reading, and honestly, a little bit more of Netflix than I'd like to say, but yeah. We're all go Tiger King.
No, absolutely. Thank you so much. This was incredible. To everyone who's on this call, thank you for staying with us. This particular recording will be up on Spotify and Savan and our webinar app and YouTube, etc. soon. Thank you so much, VP, and wish you guys all the best.
Thank you.
May we all come out of Corona stronger.